May it please the court.
You may proceed.
Good morning. Thank you, Your Honors. This case primarily relates to the attorney-client privilege, particularly in criminal matters, and what do we do when that privilege has been violated. I think it might be helpful to go through a quick timeline. Mr. Haley was arrested, the relator was arrested in this case October 25th of 2014. He's taken to the Columbia Police Department, placed a cell phone call to his attorney after requesting to speak to his attorney a couple of times and asking for that to be done in private. Subsequent to that, the Attorney General's office was appointed as a special prosecutor in this case. They sought and received an indictment for five different felonies. Four of them were vehicular assaults, which involved an element of intoxication as an allegation. After the indictment, discovery was submitted by the state to the defense attorneys in the case, and included, among other things, a disc entitled Building Video Number 5. In March of 2016, the defendant filed a request for additional disclosure from the state, specifically relating to recorded statements of the defendant in the possession of law enforcement and who had viewed those statements. Prosecutor responded to that. There was a motion to compel, and then an argument was held on that, a hearing was held on that in July of 2016. And at that hearing, the Attorney General who had the case at that time, Ms. Toll, had indicated to the court that she spoke to the Chief of Police in Columbia, as well as the arresting officer, and that they had no knowledge of any such recording existing. We then filed in September of 2016 a motion to suppress, along with a memo advising the court that we believe that this recording of attorney-client communications did exist. And that was set for hearing October 3rd of 2016, at which a special master was appointed by the consent of the parties. Special master had a hearing on December 21st, 2016, and then issued his findings on December 29th, 2016, in which he determined that, yes, there were attorney-client privileged communications on that recording, and that some steps should be taken.
Could I interrupt you for a second? When does the record show that you discovered the recording?
The record would reflect the discovery of the recording, I suppose, in our memo to the court that was filed September 14th of 2016. That's when we indicated to the court that we
had... But it had been produced to you 2 years earlier, is that right?
That is correct.
So you had it in your... How does that affect our analysis that... You simply hadn't looked at it, and the Attorney General's office said they hadn't looked at it. So everybody had it, though.
Your Honor, I don't think it does factor in, because the concern that we're dealing with is the appearance of impropriety, first of all. But second of all, the Columbia Police Department, who is an agency of the state, did look at it from the outset. They're the ones who produced it. They're the ones who recorded it. They're the ones who burned it to a disc. And they're the ones who forwarded it to the Attorney General's office so that the Attorney General's office could then forward it on to us. They were also the same people that the Attorney General's office spoke to in preparation for their case, in preparation for their indictment.
So are you challenging their statement that none of them were aware of this or looked at it or know or looked at the contents or know anything about it?
It depends on who you mean by that. If you're saying they...
The Attorney General's office.
I don't have any evidence that they have, Your Honor. And I know enough of them to know that I would hold their word to be their bond in that regard. I'm not making that accusation. But my concern is we don't know that everybody in the Attorney General's office has not viewed this at some point, that there's not some investigator somewhere who's looked at this. And what we do know is that they have talked to their investigating officers in preparation for this case. We've done depositions, we've had motions, and those officers, some of them have looked at this video. We know this because somebody at the Columbia Police Department created this video. It didn't reproduce itself. It did not send itself to the prosecutors.
Can you tell me what exactly the trial court ruled on here? Because I see in the record where they the trial court ruled that the memo would, the report would be made public. Did the trial court rule on any request by you to put up a screen or to disqualify? You all debate this issue up here, but I didn't see where there was actually a ruling below on that issue.
Yes, ma'am. The sanction that the trial court indicated it was going to impose was that it was going to bar the use at trial of the relator's refusal to take a breath test.
No, I understand that, but I didn't see where the trial court ruled on whether or not your oral request, I didn't see a written one on disqualifying the entire Attorney General's office. Is there any written ruling on that?
I don't believe there's a written ruling. I believe the judge stated that he was going to deny that request.
Okay, at the hearing?
Yes, ma'am.
But if he didn't rule on it explicitly, how do we have any authority to rule on that? There was no action taken by the trial court. The only thing the trial court did was rule on whether or not the special master's report should be sealed or unsealed.
Well, and that's a fair question, Your Honor. The issue, I suppose, is this. If he didn't rule to disqualify the Attorney General's office, the implication is they're not disqualified and they're going to proceed to trial on this case. The issue was raised. The request was made. The fact that the court was willing to proceed with the Attorney General maintaining their position as the special prosecutor in the case certainly amounts to an overruling of our request. I understand there's not a written ruling to that effect, but at some point we have to take some kind of action.
You're saying by, in effect, saying let's proceed, he has implicitly overruled that request because otherwise he wouldn't be telling the Attorney General to proceed.
Yes, ma'am. That's correct.
Where is there any appearance of impropriety if the undisputed evidence is that the Attorney General's office, that no attorney there viewed the video?
Well, first of all, I don't know that it's that's undisputed.
Well, no, you don't dispute it. You got to ask about it. So if you don't dispute it and they say they didn't, how is there an appearance of impropriety if nobody thinks the harm occurred?
Let me clarify what I said, or what I meant to say, Your Honor. I know two attorneys who indicate that they've not reviewed it at the Attorney General's office. That certainly doesn't encompass the entire Attorney General's office. And I don't think it's fair to put either Mr. Moore or Ms. Toll in the position of speaking for the entirety of the Attorney General's office as to whether or not they have looked at it. What I do know is...
What about Mr. Sauer? Is it fair to ask him?
Certainly. I would ask that you ask him whenever he gets up here. The appearance of impropriety arises from the fact that the investigating agency, who is the agent of the state in this case, the ones who initiated this, are the ones who have made this recording. They've reviewed it. Somebody there has. And they've copied it and forwarded it on to the Attorney General's office. The appearance of impropriety, actually the actual impropriety, is that these statements were recorded, they're protected, they're privileged, and they've been forwarded on.
And of course, the Columbia Police Department's not here, but I understand your concern there. Can you address why that should be imputed to the entire Attorney General's office? If I'm understanding you, you're saying we should, in the absence of proof, no one there saw it or talked to any of these officers about it, we should assume they're all disqualified? Or is the burden on them to show that they didn't see it? Or is the burden on you to show that the whole office has been tainted? How do we look at this, assuming for the moment we agree with you that there's people in the Columbia Police Department who saw this and shouldn't have seen it and they passed it on? The remedy you're saying is automatically the whole office is disqualified. Why isn't the remedy, and it may not be, why isn't the remedy to put up a screen or do something else short of disqualifying?
And I don't think that the remedy is always going to be disqualification of whatever prosecuting authority is involved. But in this case, the issue that arises is that it's too late for the screen. The issue exists with the Columbia Police Department. That's where it starts. And until every person who's looked at this video has been identified, which they haven't yet, at the Columbia Police Department, despite our efforts to find that out, everybody who's seen it has to be excluded from the case. The actual video itself, which still exists on the Columbia Police Department servers, has to be removed.
But the court's not ruled on any of those issues below, right?
Correct.
So those aren't up before us on this because we were reviewing what the trial court did.
Well, it was requested of the trial court, and the trial court refused to do that.
So what would your remedy be if this disc was sent to the regular prosecuting attorney who wasn't required or sought not to recuse, and so you receive it, you view it because you're just looking at you don't know what's on there, and you see that there's inappropriate recording of attorney-client privilege, and you immediately hand it to defense counsel. What would the remedy be in that situation?
Well, I think in that situation, that prosecutor needs to request the special prosecutor be appointed by the judge. Mm-hmm. But in addition, someone needs to make an inquiry at the law enforcement agency. Mm-hmm. Who's seen this? Who made this? And they can't be involved in this case. You've got to screen everyone from the initial investigation downstream.
Well, you're saying that has to happen here regardless of who prosecutes this case, whether it's the Attorney General or someone else.
I would suggest to you, Your Honor, that if the case were to proceed forward, the video, the recording has to be taken off of or out of Columbia Police Department's records. Whoever has seen it at the Columbia Police Department has to be identified and removed from the case. And if there's anything left of the case at that point, then a new special prosecutor can be appointed who can proceed free of the taint of having seen the privileged communication that's been recorded in this case.
Are you still proceeding on your argument that Mr. Moore's position as being a supervisor is what requires recusal or disqualification of recusal?
I certainly don't intend to abandon that here in my last 5 seconds, but I do think
you have an opportunity to answer the question.
Fair enough. I think that is an additional basis for being concerned about the appearance of impropriety in this case, because from the top down, there's opportunities for people to have knowledge about this, and the assistant attorney general who handle criminal prosecutions don't act autonomously in terms of decisions about how a case proceeds. They run it up the chain. And Daryl Moore is the top of the chain, short of Attorney General Hawley, but Daryl Moore is the one who runs the criminal prosecution division.
So you're saying a screen might be effective for a lower level assistant attorney general, but not for someone who's a deputy attorney general?
No, I'm saying that in this instance, the screen would be ineffective because of all of the issues that still exist at the fundamental level of the Columbia Police Department.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the Court, John Sauer on behalf of the respondent, Judge Tucker. I just want to start by addressing the suggestion that there hasn't been a representation by our office that no member of the Attorney General's office has viewed this particular recording. We said at page 17 of our brief, no member of the Attorney General's office ever reviewed the recording, and Haley can cite no evidence to the contrary. I stand by that representation, and that's supported by all the evidence that was submitted, which includes the sworn testimony at the special master hearing from the investigator on the case, Steve Hayden, the written representation of Assistant Attorney General Toll before she left the office, and the representations to the court of Mr. Moore in the special master hearing and before the circuit judge.
Can you address opposing counsel's argument that somebody at the Columbia Police Department had to make a specific decision to record this and send it to your office, to your predecessor's office, and therefore someone there has seen it, and that taints the entire investigation?
I would say two things in response to that. First of all, he repeated, I think what he's doing is because there's really no evidence that the Attorney General's office engaged in any impropriety, he's attempting to sort of pull the mistakes that were made at the Columbia Police Department and impute them, in your words, to the Attorney General's office. And I think in doing that, what he's doing is he's really conflating the Sixth Amendment cases that consider whether dismissal should be a sanction for the conduct of police officers from the disqualification cases this court has decided, like LeMasters and in cases of that
nature. You're saying later on the court can address issues of evidence admissibility and so forth, but that's a different issue than who can prosecute the case.
Absolutely. When considering disqualification, I think it's the conduct of attorneys that the court looks at and considers whether there's an appearance of impropriety in these attorneys proceeding with the case. As you pointed out, regardless of which prosecutor handles this case, that prosecutor is going to have to deal with the issue that Columbia Police Department did create this recording. We have conceded that it violated the Sixth Amendment, it violated the statute, and it violated their policies. And that puts us, in a sense, not necessarily on the same page with them as to all the issues in this particular case. But whatever prosecutor handles this case is going to have to deal with those particular kinds of issues and suppression issues. A lot of those were addressed at the special master's hearing because Mr. Farrow had the opportunity to call witnesses from the Columbia Police Department, and he did call three. He called the arresting officer, who testified that he had never reviewed the recording. He called the records custodian and the evidence custodian. Both of them testified that they had never reviewed the recording. But interestingly, in paragraph 14 of the special master's report, the special master notes that one of those witnesses says there is somebody who's in charge of these in-house recordings who would be the person who could explain this, and there was no follow-up, there was no attempt to call that particular person, put them on the stand, and say, why did the Columbia Police Department create this particular recording? Now, as proceedings go forward, will he have an opportunity to attempt to renew that issue? That I think that will depend on the sound discretion of the trial court.
Opposing counsel says he has objections to the report, that he thinks there was more attorney-client privileged information discussed that the master didn't find. Perhaps somebody else with better hearing might have listened to it at the Columbia Police Department or elsewhere. And has that been reviewed by the trial judge? Is that before us at this point?
The trial judge...
Is there an avenue for review of that objection?
I think there is, Your Honor. I think that objection is preserved and ruled on, because at the March 2nd hearing, what the trial judge did is he said, initially, Mr. Farrow had requested a special master because he did not want the trial judge to review the communications before going to trial. But when the trial judge concluded that a lot of it can't be heard, and Mr. Farrow disagrees and says, I think I can hear a lot of this stuff, and I disagree with your characterization, the special master, or the trial judge said, look, he wasn't comfortable reviewing it. So he said, why don't you, Mr. Farrow, make a generalized offer of proof as to what you think is in there that I would hear if I were to review it. And if your offer of proof indicates that there's any trial strategy on here, then I will look at that issue. So actually, he was given opportunities in the February 9th hearing and the March 2nd hearing to make that offer of proof, and he only offered three things. He said, there's a discussion.
And these are things that we can say here without revealing any attorney-client?
I believe so, because they were said on the record in open court at the February 9th hearing, and then again in the March, I believe in the closed portion of the hearing.
Why should any portion of the recording be available?
We don't dispute that it would make sense to seal paragraph 10 of the special master's report. I agree that no portion of the recording should be available. And if the court is more comfortable, I would just direct your attention to, I think it's pages 9 and 10 of the March 2nd transcript, where he does make that offer of proof. He offers three things that he says are in the recording, and the trial judge addresses those and says those are not trial strategy, and those are things that could easily address.
Why is the report made public? Why does the Attorney General think the report, any part of the report, should be made public?
Because of First Amendment issues. So as we've argued in our brief, the vast majority of the special master's report, all of it, I would say, except for paragraph 10, doesn't raise any issues that relate to attorney-client privilege, and there's a First Amendment right of access to those. And I think we come to agreement.
Who's First Amendment right of access?
The media, the general public, has a First Amendment right of access to. I mean, this is a proceeding that does have substantial public interest in it, and there really is. The First Amendment says that any sort of redaction of that particular report should be narrowly tailored to address the compelling interest in protecting the attorney-client communications. I think we reached agreement on that in the briefing, because as I read his reply brief, he says, I'm only asking for the suppression or the sort of redaction of paragraph 10, and the Attorney General's office doesn't object to that particular, keeping that particular portion of the special master's report.
Are the other issues properly before us when they're not subject to a written ruling by the trial judge?
I don't dispute what he said about the issue of disqualification. That was orally denied at both the hearings, certainly at the March 2nd hearing. And I view the ruling where he adopts the special master's report and proceeds on that as impliedly denying the desire to, or his request to disqualify the Attorney General's office. I will will say that in his reply brief, he says, also, please dismiss all the charges. That, I believe, is not properly before the court. It wasn't raised in his opening brief. There's no point relied on that refers to that. We didn't have the opportunity to brief that on a responsive brief. So he talks about these Washington State cases in the reply brief that were raised for the first time in that particular reply brief. But I think the issue of the disqualification is properly before the court.
Counsel, I read the transcript from the March hearing to say that the judge was going to rule on whether paragraph 10 should be redacted or sealed, and come back and allow the parties to seek a writ on that issue and come back and decide the issue of remedy. Am I wrong about that?
I believe there's an exchange at the very end of that particular back and forth between the trial judge and Mr. Farrow, where the trial judge says, well, Mr. Farrow, what's your preference? Do you want me to deny your motion to reconsider what I'm doing with the special master's report, or leave it open for you to come back? And Mr. Farrow says, I want you to deny it, and I believe that was the trial judge's ruling. So I think there was a ruling denying the motion to reconsider. I could be wrong about that, though.
To reconsider what?
To reconsider his adoption of the special master's findings and conclusions.
Which doesn't say anything about remedy.
That is correct. I do believe, though, that
so we have no motion to disqualify. We have suggestions about what the remedy should be, and the court making no express finding about what the remedy should or shouldn't be.
I believe, certainly orally, he concluded that the appropriate remedy was suppression of any content of that conversation and suppression of the refusal to take the breath test, which otherwise would be very important evidence against the defendant. But I don't know if that's in the written ruling, Your Honor. I'm not sure.
Does suppress the blood draw and any of that, but you're saying implicitly he rejected everything else when he ruled that.
I believe he implicitly...
Or the parties have treated it as that.
We have. On the disqualification issue, which I take it is the critical issue before us, I believe there has been a ruling as to that, but it is, as I stand here, I don't recall whether the written order makes any express ruling on disqualification, or I believe it does expressly state that the remedy of all these issues related to this particular problem of there being this recorded communication was suppression of the recorded communication itself and suppression of the refusal to take the breathalyzer test.
Is the remedy to disqualify the prosecutor's office even appropriate remedy under a motion to suppress, or should that be a completely separate analysis and motion?
I believe that it would certainly be preferable and cleaner if it were done by a separate motion. I think that really what he was asking for, and most of the discussion is about, is seeking the sanction of dismissal of the entire case. And so disqualification of the prosecutor, I mean, those are two distinct inquiries, but disqualification of the prosecutor came up in the context of his attempt to get the entire case dismissed. And I believe that, you know, probably would have been better to have a separate motion to disqualify. But as I stand at the podium, I do believe that there was at least an implicit ruling on the request for disqualification. There's an explicit oral ruling, even if it's not reflected in the actual.
So why shouldn't the entire Attorney General's office be disqualified due to an appearance of impropriety because of the sharing of this video by the Columbia Police Department?
I would start by pointing out that the court should focus on the conduct of the attorneys, not the conduct of the law enforcement officers, when considering that particular question. The standard is whether a reasonable person apprised of all the facts and circumstances would conclude that there was an appearance of impropriety. I would point to three factual factors that I believe recur again and again in the disqualification cases and in the related context of the Sixth Amendment. First, did the prosecutor know, or should they have known, that they were intruding on a privileged communication? Secondly, did they have actual knowledge of the contents of that communication? And thirdly, did that communication create trial strategy? So I would draw a contrast, for example. And in that case, the evidence here is that as to the conduct of the Attorney General's office, none of those three factors are satisfied.
And I guess that's where I'm getting them. That's why I'm frustrated, because it doesn't appear that the trial court addressed those and analyzed those factors. He was analyzing under a remedy for a suppression issue. And shouldn't it be more appropriate to send this back and say, hey, trial court, why don't you look at this, and then we can deal with that after it's properly been set up before the trial court?
Because this is in the posture of a petition for writ of mandamus, I would think that the appropriate thing for the court to do would be to simply deny the petition for writ of mandamus and maybe opine that you know, further inquiry on this might make sense and be helpful.
The trial court made no findings with respect to those issues, and there was no argument with respect to those issues, were they?
I think there was extensive back and forth as to whether or not, number one, did the Attorney General's office know what was on the tape? And that's been very clearly established. Secondly, did the Attorney General, what was the conduct of the Attorney General's office once they became aware in on October 3rd of 2016 that we'd had this thing on our files for 2 years? You know, there were immediate representations, both by Assistant Attorney General Toll and by Mr. Moore, that, you know, we have not viewed this, no one in our office is looking at it. There was an offer at the special master's hearing in December of Mr. Moore. He offered to surrender the only copy that we had to the special master, and the special master actually declined that. Mr. Moore, again, at the February hearing, offered the circuit court to surrender it, and the circuit court said, well, why don't you give it to Mr. Farrow, which is what actually happened. So there was an immediate attempt to relinquish it. There's a lot in the record here showing that essentially the assistant attorney generals here really did, they behaved reasonably and properly, they reacted appropriately, and they did their best to sort of quarantine the situation and present it to the appropriate authorities. Under those circumstances, I think the court would be very well justified in concluding that, in fact, the ruling that their disqualification is not warranted isn't supported by the evidence. In other words, even though these two hearings focused extensively on the question of whether or not dismissal was an appropriate sanction for the Sixth Amendment, which isn't presented in these writ proceedings, there also was, in the process, pretty significant discussion of whether or not disqualification was appropriate. And I think the court could very appropriately reach that issue in this writ and conclude that there's no basis for disqualification.
Can you comment on a case from our court from 1990? It's the Wakehesser versus State case, where we said that a prosecutor should not serve if he's had access to privileged information, because the Attorney General's office has had access to this information for a considerable period of time. Doesn't that lend to the AG's office being disqualified?
I would quibble with the meaning of the word access. Certainly, potentially, somebody at some point could have looked at the disk, not knowing in advance what was on it, and at that point been exposed to these attorney-client communications. But because, in truth, in fact, that never happened, I don't think there's any reason to suggest that there's an impropriety with these particular prosecutors in going forward. And I would point out in that particular case, if it's the Wakehesser case, W-A-C-A-S-E-R, in that particular case, I believe, the judge actually held a hearing where he brought in that prosecutor who had been an associate circuit judge, had ruled in the divorce proceeding, and then had been part of the firm that had represented this particular criminal defendant in her divorce proceeding, then brought him in and said, well, did you actually, you know, have exposure to any information that could possibly taint your conduct as a prosecutor, and accepted that prosecutor's representation. So I believe that the facts of that case strongly support the conclusion here that the Attorney General's office, who has made the similar representations and had them accepted both by the special master and by the circuit court, that there has been no exposure to any information that would result in any intrusion on the attorney-client privilege by the prosecutors in the case.
If we interpret access differently, would that require recusal of the entire Attorney General's office, or just the specific attorneys who had access? Did everybody have access if they were in the office?
I would think that the people who would have access would be Assistant Attorney General Toll, who had that in her file. I mean, we're probably talking about literally a folder with a bunch of documents and a disk, and several disks in it. So it'd be Assistant Attorney General Toll, and then she transferred the case to Daryl Moore in our office, and I believe Mr. Goodwin. I mean, our position is that no ethical screen is required here.
Can you address the supervisor issue that as supervisor, everybody beneath him it would also share the taint because they wouldn't want to contravene whatever? He's got authority over them.
Yes, a totally different situation, because that the boss comment came in a case where it was the elected prosecutor who had defended that particular defendant in a closely related case. Mr. Moore is an important person in our office. He is not the boss. The elected attorney general is the boss. We could certainly screen off Mr. Moore if we had to and create a reporting line from the attorney general to other prosecutors in the office, perhaps through the deputy attorney general for civil proceedings. Mr. Moore actually reports to me in our organizational structure, and I report to the Attorney General, so he's at the third level of our reporting structure. I see my time's expired.
The language in the Wakehesser case and Ross talks about potential access and had access isn't that the better rule? Because it would be impossible, likely impossible, for a defendant to prove that someone with access, what they had actually done. And so when, in fact, the information, the privileged information is possessed, if that's the disqualifying factor, then that relieves the defendant of an impossible burden to prove what happened to that information.
I don't think that's the best interpretation of the word access when the rest of the facts are that there was no prosecutor engaged in conduct they knew or should have known constituted an intrusion, no prosecutor ever came into actual knowledge of the contents of the communication, and the communications, according to the special master, don't contain any particular trial strategy. So the converse case, the case where they said, I believe this court said in the Winkler case, or actually the Eastern District, the Court of Appeals said in the Winkler case, where assistant prosecuting attorneys had sort of no, in situations they should have known what they were doing was wrong, interviewed the husband about privileged communications that he and the wife, who was the criminal defendant, had with their attorney, there was this deliberate intrusion. There the court said, well, because there was actual knowledge here and we can never know what other assistant prosecutors in that particular office might have done, that the access issue required the disqualification of the entire prosecutor's office in that case. But here, where there's no evidence, no reason to believe that any prosecutor in the Attorney General's office has ever had actual access, so to speak, to this, that I don't think the court should conclude that there's any appearance of impropriety. Thank you, Your Honors.
With respect to the issue of the appearance of impropriety, when this video was produced to the Attorney General's office, it apparently was not identified as a recording of a privileged communication between an attorney and his client. And therefore, they did not know that we had this video in our possession right away, so they could turn it over, they could give it to us, they could notify the judge and start a screening process. But now that we all know that the Attorney General's office had this video for 2 years before they relinquished it from the Columbia Police Department, the appearance of impropriety is clear. It's public knowledge that the Columbia Police Department recorded these conversations based on the reporting on what was argued about the special master's report. So the appearance, which what we're concerned about is what a reasonable person would believe based on the facts that they know, the appearance damages the criminal justice system if the Attorney General's office is allowed to continue as the special prosecutor in this case. Because a reasonable person hearing that the Columbia Police Department recorded a phone call between a client and his attorney and then burned that to disk and sent it to the Attorney General's office, and it sat in their file for 2 years unreviewed, even though it was, as far as they knew, another piece of evidence that was part of the case, completely unreviewed by them until somebody else said, hey, this video has something on it it's not supposed to have. Then they divested themselves of it, which I would advise the court, in October of 2016, when we initially had a hearing on this in front of the respondent in this case, I asked that the video be relinquished to the court, and Judge Tucker indicated that no, the state could hold on to their copy. The appearance that exists is something that undermines the public's confidence in the criminal justice system in this case, and the only way to remedy that is to take, first of all, the video away from the police department so it's not an ongoing violation of that issue, the privilege, and secondly, to then appoint a special prosecutor to go forward with the case after the video's been purged and the officers who have reviewed the video have also been screened off from the prosecution of the case, the investigation of the case.
Could you respond to Mr. Sauer's statement that you called witnesses at the master's hearing who said they had not seen it, And that an officer was identified as being the officer who was in charge of these types of recording, and you did not seek to get testimony from that officer?
I can. As you'll recall, we filed a motion for additional disclosure in March of 2016 asking for the names of every officer who had seen any recorded conversation of the defendant. Words to that effect. And none was identified to us. Then, at this hearing, we called the two logical people to call as possibly the ones who produced this video, the evidence custodian and the, I think it was an IT person at the police department. Both of those people disavowed any knowledge, and they both said, well, it might have been the administrative assistant to the chief who ran that copy off, which is interesting in that the chief was one of the people who was identified by Ms. Toll as somebody who said nobody else has seen a copy of this. So shortly after that, we got a ruling from the special master that this was a privileged communication. And at that point, I think the burden shifts to the state to call that witness to say, hey, I didn't look at it. We just made a copy of a video that somebody pointed out for whatever reason, and that's why we did it.
Was the distinction made that information could have been that officers or others didn't have to view the video, that wasn't the only way they could get information? They could get information from the officers who did view it. So simply inquiring as to whether the officer saw it themselves is not the same thing as indicating they don't have information as to what was on it.
I don't believe that distinction was ever made, Your Honor, but that's an excellent point, and one that I think I've tried to argue in terms of how the information about the video could get into the hands of the Attorney General without them actually reviewing the video.
Again, I don't want to keep getting back to this, but is this brought up during the suppression hearing that is a remedy that the Columbia Police Department had to divest themselves of this, the computer records of this? Has this been properly before the trial court, I guess, is my question.
And that's a fair question. That I'll confess to suffering a low-grade panic whenever this issue became an issue for us to deal with. We filed a motion to suppress, but we also filed a memo with the court that we filed in September of 2016 indicating that this video that had attorney-client privileged information was in possession of the Attorney General's office. And we needed a special master to be appointed in order to review that video and determine what steps should be taken. That was what we filed with the court. Should it have been a motion, a motion for particular outcomes, particular remedies? Probably. But we wanted the court to make a determination as to whether or not the attorney-client privilege had been invaded.
Well, and I guess that's my point here, is that, okay, so now we're there. We've got that special master report. It's been adopted by the court. There's been a finding that there's a Sixth Amendment violation. And now, and arguably there's been a determination that the appropriate remedy does not include dismissal, but exclusion of this evidence. Now, shouldn't there be litigation before the trial court about other potential issues, disqualification, purging of the records at Columbia Police Department? Doesn't that seem to be the better way to go? And then we can seek appropriate remedies with this court if the trial court doesn't rule appropriately.
I would suggest to you, Judge Powell, that when we filed our objections to the special master's report, those were all issues that we did raise in those objections. That these were the sanctions, these were the actions that we believe the trial court should take in response to the violation of the privilege.
And do you agree with Mr. Sauer that the trial court ruled on what the sanction should be, and that was to suppress the results of the blood alcohol test?
No, that wasn't the sanction, at least not that I recall. The sanction that the trial court came up with was that there could be no mention of relators refusal to take a breath test. The judge refused to suppress the blood alcohol evidence that was obtained subsequently. So that's still, as far as we're concerned, a part of the trial.
And the court has not ruled, though, on your objections about the Columbia Police Department, which wasn't before the court in any way. And no, they didn't testify. There was no hearing on what they knew and who knew what and what they did.
That's correct, Your Honor. We had raised those issues in our objections to the special master report.
But there hadn't been a hearing on that, as far as I could see in the record.
Agreed.
And in your objections, you asked that the evidence be excluded, that the AG relinquish their copy of the recording, that the CPD purge their computers of any copies of the recording, and that all the charges be dismissed. In your objections, did you say that the AG's office should be disqualified in its entirety?
I don't believe we did in our written objections, Your Honor, but I think that is an issue that we've raised in both the initial hearing that was in, I believe, at the beginning of February, and in the motion for rehearing in March.
Okay. Was there a trial date set and the case would have gone to trial if the writ had not been issued?
Yes. And we've had a couple since then, actually.
When was the trial date?
Well, I don't know the initial one. It was, I believe, in June of 2017. After the Eastern District granted the preliminary writ, that was then moved, and it was rescheduled for trial January 3rd of 2018.
So it would have been tried at the 1st of January of this year, but for the writ proceedings?
Presuming that everything else could be fixed, yes, ma'am.
Case will be submitted.
Thank you.